Good morning. This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to the February 10th, 2016 edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way on the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. You may have heard the comment in the past, "Poor Mexico, so far from God, so close to the United States." It has been attributed without evidence and probably incorrectly to Porfirio Diaz, a powerful, corrupt Mexican president of a century ago. Whatever its origin, the sentiment it expresses summarizes the sad and uncomfortable relations between our two countries, of which predictably we were reminded again last night by Donald Trump in his victory speech to a crowd of cheering supporters in New Hampshire. Long before Trump and his raving racist xenophobes appeared on the scene, that relationship has been indelibly marked by never-ending and rarely questioned abuse by the United States of its southern neighbor going back to the invasion of Mexico in 1846. That unprovoked war led to the largest land grab in modern history, what became the western half of the United States, and what Ulysses Grant described as, quote, one of the most unjust ever waged by a stronger against a weaker nation, end quote. That's a quote you're not likely to find in history textbooks in our public schools, which rationalized the war as an expression of America's manifest destiny. The latest chapter in that sordid history has been on display throughout the endless series of Republican presidential debates, with one leading candidate after another competing as to who will be the toughest on walling off our border with Mexico. Who will be the most resolute in cracking down on undocumented immigrants from that country who have been compelled by a history of U.S.-dictated economic policies to seek a better life on this side of the border, despite the risks that doing so entails? That story and those whose lives have been placed in limbo and why will be the topic of discussion at about 20 minutes past the hour when I speak with Professor Roberto Gonzalez about his recent book, appropriately titled Lives in Limbo, Undocumented and Coming of Age in America. So stay tuned for that. Over the years since its inception and as long as I've been listening to it, NPR has played an important role in supporting U.S. foreign policy maneuvers, to the point where some critics have referred to it at times as national propaganda radio. Last week, we heard one such example following the decision of President Obama to escalate tensions with Russia and Eastern Europe by allocating more than $3 billion to be spent on weaponry and stationing U.S. troops on Russia's borders to deter its non-existent threats of aggression. On Thursday, listeners to Morning Edition heard host Mary Louise Kelly say, quote, "Reading the headlines this week, you could be forgiven for feeling a flashback to the Cold War. The Obama administration announced plans to deploy more heavy weapons, more armored vehicles, and more troops to Central and Eastern Europe, an increase of close to $3 billion in military spending, all of it aimed at Russia, specifically at deterring Russian aggression in the region. And that's why we have brought in our next guest, Evelyn Farkas, was until last year the top Russia official at the Pentagon. She's here with us in our studios." When asked what signal was this meant to send, Farkas replied, "Absolutely a signal to our NATO allies that we are with them and obviously a very strong signal to Russia that we want to deter them. I think what's exciting about this, Mary Louise," and yes, she used the word exciting, "is that, you know, here we are, all of us focused on Iowa and the next president, and what's the next president going to do and who it's going to be. And this president has signaled very strong to us, hey, I'm still in the game. This is a very bold move." He almost quadrupled, actually more than quadrupled, the spending on deterring Russia through our military exercise program and these deployments. Her enthusiasm did not go unnoticed by Kelly. "You just used the words bold and exciting," she remarked. "I know that when you were at the Pentagon, you were pushing hard for the U.S. to push back more aggressively against Russian aggression. Do you feel like this is now the right balance?" responded Farkas. "I think this is absolutely a fantastic step. There are other things that we need to do, and I believe that the administration is working also on those aspects of our approach to Russia. And obviously, none of this work is going to be completed in this administration, sadly, mainly because the Russian perspective is not going to change in the next year or so. But this is absolutely such a strong, exciting signal," said Farkas, "that the president's sending, and of course the Pentagon's been working hard on putting this package together for a while." End quote. Well, Farkas had a reason to celebrate. Last September, she resigned from her position in the State Department over what appeared to be her failed efforts to escalate a confrontation with Russia over the Ukraine and its annexation of Crimea. In testimony last year before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Farkas took a hard line on Russia, saying that country's actions, quote, stand as an affront to the international order that we and our allies have worked to build since the end of the Cold War, end quote. She went on, Russia's illegal annexation of Crimea, followed by blatant, unconcealed efforts to destabilize eastern and southern Ukraine, signifies a paradigm shift for our relations with Russia, she said in prepared testimony. As the crisis deepens, our European allies and partners will look to the United States to demonstrate resolve and to reinforce solidarity across the continent. End quote. So it was not surprising that NPR would go to a hawk like that when President Obama adopted her position and escalated the new Cold War. The next day, Friday, Morning Edition was back at it with Renee Montagne interviewing Lieutenant General Ben Hodges, the commanding U.S. Army general in Europe. Mary Louise Kelly provided the setting, quote, European countries, she said, had already been bulking up their own defense budgets after Russia's incursion into Ukraine and its seizing of Crimea. Now the U.S. is offering those allies some reassurance. There was no incursion into Ukraine. But on came Montaigne, who told us, quote, one man who's been pushing for those funds is Lieutenant General Ben Hodges. He's the commanding general for the U.S. Army in Europe. And when we reached him at his headquarters in Germany, he said his mission is similar to that of generals past, with one difference, a much smaller fighting force at the ready. Well, said General Hodges, there used to be 300,000 soldiers in Europe during the height of the Cold War, 300,000 mostly in Germany. Today we have 30,000 distributed all over Central and Eastern Europe with the same mission to assure our allies and to deter Russia, just like we did in the Cold War. So the task force is to make 30,000 look and feel like 300,000 in terms of our strategic effort. Without this additional contingency funding, he said, we would not be able to provide the deterrent effect that we need to prevent further aggression. It would be insufficient. This is about speed, speed of recognition and impending crisis, and then speed of assembly, said Hodges. If we can put troops with equipment quickly in an area ahead of it turning into a real crisis, we've given our political leaders some options, and then we can prevent it actually ever having to fight. That's why this equipment is so important. It will help us with our deterrence, end quote. What NPR listeners will never hear are military and foreign policy experts who have questioned U.S. policy toward Russia and who have no vested interest in pushing an aggressive posture toward the Putin government. You will never be reminded that the origin of this new Cold War was Washington's behind-the-scenes promotion of the coup that overthrew Ukraine's elected president in 2014. Before that, there was no hint of Russian aggression towards its Eastern European neighbors, and the U.S. was hard-pressed to find a continuing need to continue NATO. If you were listening to Takes on the World before the Ukraine coup, you would have heard me playing two recordings of Deputy Secretary of State for Europe Victoria Nuland Kagan, the neocon wife of Project for New American Century co-founder Robert Kagan. The first was of her speaking to a Ukrainian-American organization in Washington in which she boasted that the U.S. had spent $5 billion, that's billion with a B, to orchestrate regime change in Ukraine. The second was part of a secretly taped phone conversation with a co-conspirator, U.S. Ambassador Jeff Pyatt, before the coup, which she announced her choice for Ukraine's prime minister following the coup. Her choice was Anseli Yatsenyuk, an American puppet, and that's who it turned out to be. Both of those recordings were significant, and it was equally significant that NPR did not choose to broadcast either one of them. Well, this past Sunday in Consortium News, Gilbert Doctorow reported that a new French documentary has exposed the grim reality from which Americans had been carefully shielded, that Ukraine's Maidan Square Uprising, that overthrew the elected president and installed a U.S.-backed, fiercely anti-Russian regime, had unleashed armed neo-Nazis. Ukraine today, with U.S. support, is in the grip of extreme right-wing nationalists who seek to impose a view of nationhood that does not accept minorities or heterogeneity, Doctorow wrote. As he pointed out, rainbow politics is not what the Maidan Uprising was all about. By the way, one can imagine if Russia was behind a coup in Mexico and stationed its troops on our border. Imagine that. Well, on my last program, I reported that when Hillary Clinton has been asked by a reporter for The Intercept if she would release the text of her speeches to Goldman Sachs, she laughed in his face and walked away. She wasn't exactly laughing when asked the same questions by MSNBC's Chris Todd during last Thursday's debate with Bernie Sanders in the run-up to last night's election. And she probably wasn't laughing after last night either, but pretending that she had no idea of what she had said because she gives so many talks to so many groups on world affairs, she concluded by saying she would look into it. Then this past Sunday, she said she would be willing to release the text of speeches she gave to big banks if other politicians running in the race released their behind-closed-door transcripts. You know, I don't mind being the subject in the Republican debates, the subject in the Democratic primary, she added. That kind of goes with the territory. I've been around long enough. But sometimes, you know, these rules need to apply to everybody. She said a bunch of her opponents in the White House race had given speeches to high-profile groups. She said, if this is now going to be a new standard, so when it should apply to everybody, and then I'll be happy to look into it further. In other words, what she had said had to say to Goldman Sachs will not be forthcoming anytime soon, and her only official opponent at the moment, Senator Bernie Sanders, who trounced her last night in New Hampshire, does not suffer from the same financial conflicts. Clinton and her husband Bill have racked up $153 million in speaker fees since 2001, including $1.8 million from eight financial firms, including Goldman Sachs and UBS. On my last program, I reported about the insidious involvement of both Clintons in Haitian politics, and particularly Hillary, in manipulating the election of singer Michel Martelly as the country's president in 2011. Martelly stepped down Sunday after a five-year term in office in which he largely dismantled the country's parliamentary system and did so in the face of what promised to be a mass popular uprising. Representatives from the Organization of American States held meetings with Martelly and parliamentarians remaining this week to forge a last-minute arrangement for an interim government. Current Prime Minister Evans Paul will remain in office while Parliament selects an interim president. The postponed presidential and parliamentary runoffs are now scheduled for April 24th, with plans for the new president to take office May 14th. It was on February 7th, 1986, that the people of Haiti ended the reign of baby doc Jean-Claude Duvalier, and 30 years later, as Haitian lawyer Zélie Danto described it, revolutionary Haiti honored the victims of the Duvalier and Martelly U.S.-supported dictatorship by coldly stopping a replica of Martelly from being installed in fake elections. We cancel the annual carnival set to start, she said, and stop the grotesque king of carnivals' repressive rule, his gross indecency. We refuse to obey. End quote. At this point, it's an open question as to whether either Clinton will be invited to make an appearance there. Well, I've reported in the past months about ongoing negotiations between Washington and Tel Aviv about the size of the next massive U.S. giveaway to Israel. What has been generally agreed between both sides is that the package will be larger than the last 10-year agreement, which provided Israel with more than $30 billion of U.S. taxpayers' funds with which to purchase U.S. weapons of war. The question is how large, and the Israelis, whose collective sense of entitlement is equal only by their lack of gratitude, want to extract as much as they can from Uncle Sam's treasury. Citing a high-ranking Israeli official, Reuters reported on Monday that Israel may be unable to reach a new defense aid agreement with the Obama administration and could wait for the next U.S. president to secure better terms, in a veiled rebuke signaling a snag in negotiations. But a senior U.S. official urged Israel to accept an increased 10-year multi-billion-dollar package that President Obama is offering, saying that whoever occupies the White House next year would be unlikely to demonstrate any greater commitment to Israel's security. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, knowing the degree of Hillary Clinton's thraldom to Israeli billionaire Haim Saban and the prospect that whoever is a Republican candidate will likely sell himself to his good friend Sheldon Adelson, he has good reason to expect the next U.S. president will offer a more generous arrangement. Differences between the two sides, which surfaced after a week of negotiations on a new defense memorandum of understanding last week, underscored what Reuters described as a, quote, continuing tensions over last year's U.S.-led nuclear deal with Iran, Israel's regional arch foe. Netanyahu was quoted by Israeli media on Monday as telling his cabinet that if Israel's security needs were not sufficiently met, he would hold off on signing an aid deal and wait for the next U.S. president, who will take office in January. In an apparent swipe at the Obama administration, according to Reuters, Cabinet Minister Zev Elkin, a Netanyahu confidant in the ruling right-wing Likud party, said Israel was still waiting for a realistic offer from the United States. Officials say Netanyahu opened talks with requests for an increase to $5 billion annually, an amount the U.S. was unlikely to accept. An Israeli official said Monday that Netanyahu was hoping for about $4 billion and would seek hundreds of millions of dollars separately for military projects such as missile defense. A U.S. congressional source, however, said discussions had focused on a U.S. offer of about $3.7 billion. When the accord with Iran passed, the U.S. president pledged that he would do everything to provide a proper response for Israel's security, Elkin told Israel's Army Radio. Nevertheless, he said it was, quote, possible that Netanyahu would wait for the next White House occupant to clinch a memorandum of understanding. There's a word in both Yiddish and German that aptly describes Israel's relationship to the United States. That word is schnorrer, S-C-H-N-O-R-R-E-R. Look it up on Wikipedia and see if you don't agree. Curiously, U.S. support for Israel has been less of a factor in the presidential debates than in the past election years, and that may be due to the fact that apart from Christian evangelicals, support for Israel among the American public, particularly those under 30, have been falling for years. What the Israelis and their American supporters fear is that one day the growing boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement targeting Israel that has been attracting adherents in the United States among leading academic organizations and Protestant clergy will suddenly take off and explode, as did the movement against South African apartheid. Then, for all intents and purposes, Israel will become a pariah state, having finally exhausted the world's goodwill and sympathy built up after the Jewish Holocaust. What makes it different from South Africa is that it has several hundred nuclear weapons about which our government and our media dare not. This is Jeff Blankford. Thank you for listening.